looking like two-headed aliens. Follow the money trail that leads to the criminal, and nothing subliminal to it. That's how they do it. See the game they run. Give a fuck who's cunning, articulate, and handsome. Afghanistan held for ransom by the hand of this black man. Neo-colonial puppet, white power with a black face. He said, puppet, I'll do it. A master of disguise, expert at telling lies. Then they gave him a Nobel Peace Prize. Should have known he was trained in Chicago. Word to Chairman Fred and Mark Clark. What they do in the dark will come out in the light like a WikiLeaks site. So I guess Nkrumah was right. Who's ready to fight? Last stage of imperialism, I ain't kidding. In the immortal words of Marvin Gaye, this ain't living.
Strip was getting bomb, Obama didn't say bitch. OBAMA, you ain't fooling everyone. I see the games you play. See you as VIP at the BIC, and we know that's a code name for CIA. The same way your cameras are watching us, we're watching you. Think we're easy to control, you ain't got a clue. Revolution's on the way, let's see what you're gonna do. You're gonna send the troops, you're gonna drop the loops. See, it's not where you're from, it's where you're at. He's sitting in the White House, so who cares if he's black? And why is there soldiers still out there in the rack? Natural resources ain't yours, it's theirs, give it back. You're just another puppet, but I'm not surprised. Look at Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. They didn't change ish. House niggas fresh off the slave ship. You all burn in hell, even Michelle Obama nation.
Strip was getting bomb, Obama didn't say
shit. The bigger threat from Osama or from Obama? Military bases from Chagos to Okinawa. I say things that other rappers won't say, cause my mind never closed like Guantanamo Bay. Hope you didn't feel the statue or tattoo your arm, cause the drones are still flying over Pashtunistan. Did he defend the war?
No.
He extended more, even had the time to attempt a coup in Ecuador. Morales and Chavez, the states are on the hunt for ya. Military now stationed on bases in Colombia. Take a trip to the past and tell them I was right. Ask Ali Abu Nima and Jeremiah Wright. Drones over Pakistan, Yemen and Libya. Is Obama the bomber getting ready for Syria? First black president, the masses were hungry, but the same president just bombed an African country like...
Strip was getting bombed, Obama didn't say shit.
The Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. Sasha and Malia are huge fans. But boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming. You think I'm joking?
Thank you for listening to Earthwatch tonight here on the AI. Please send an email to your host, Robert Knight. That's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf coming up with Jim Freund.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Dr. D.T. Friedman. That's Danielle Friedman, but she's a writer, she's a doctor. So just stay tuned, you'll get a great story from it.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. So what are we supposed to do with Ender's Game, It's gotten all mucked up in the politics of the author, which normally wouldn't be that much of a problem. This isn't the first time that art has been greater than the artist who created it, after all. Except for the fact that the manure that Orson Scott Card has spilled out against gay rights has been particularly vile, something made all the more ironic for it coming from a man who created a book as wise, empathetic, and beloved as Ender's Game. What compensates significantly is that Ender's Game, the movie, has passed through many hands in order to get to the screen, most of the more high-profile of whom have gone on record with how full of crap Scott Card is. The work will always be shaded with the bad will of its creator, but the film does at least merit consideration on its own. And unfortunately, for such a deservedly revered story, I wish the film was far better than it actually is. Granted, it would be a challenge for the best of directors to nail this tale of a young boy being groomed against his will for a leadership position in an interstellar war. The project's been in process for over a decade, and time may not have hindered the telling, but it didn't particularly help either. The director, Gavin Hood, who has to his credit the well-received drama Tsotsi and the not-as-well-received X-Men Origins Wolverine, take that as you will, approaches the story with a sort of stolid caution. The tone here will not be unfamiliar to anyone who'd seen this year's previous After Earth, all three of you, same grimness, same airless dramatics. Whether this comes out of respect for the source material or anxiety over depicting young children being deliberately driven to violence, or just as likely a combination of both, it does suck the life out of the scenario, ironically blunting the very point the film is trying to make. The time frame has also been compressed, starting off with the recruits already in their teens, understandable from the standpoint of a film narrative, but again losing a crucial point of the story. That the teen members of the cast, star Asa Butterfield included, tend to play their parts with a deadened flatness may not again be completely their fault. They'd be hard roles for adults, and director Hood has to rally an ensemble of such characters. Ironically, Harrison Ford, who plays the officer in charge of the training program and who has gone through his most recent work with an attitude that could best be characterized as surly resignation, here delivers one of his more appealing performances, somehow nailing a demeanor that mixes steely determination with paternal concern. Given the character's ultimate goals, it makes him all the more unsettling. And then there's the end of the film, which I will not spoil here, but which, as I sort of feared, presented its own problems. If you have read the book, you may well feel that Hood does right by Card at this point, finally bringing the story to an emotionally powerful conclusion. But I've spoken to people who have never read the book and who, as I feared, generally felt that what this tale was leading up to was at best anticlimactic. That's a failure there as well, because anticlimax though the ending may be, you're supposed to feel it as a gut blow and derive a deeper understanding of what young Ender has been put through and what he now has to live with. So, yes, failure is the word we need to use with Ender's Game. But can we also grant that, at the very least, there was an honest attempt here to tell a science fiction story that wasn't just adrenaline or tongue-in-cheek pop culture recapitulation? That in its flawed way, this film at least attempted to take us on a journey that had more consequence than, yay, the good guys beat the bad guys. That has value in and of itself, and I do hope that when the people behind the scenes analyze what went wrong with Ender's Game, tried to make the audience think, doesn't wind up in that list. I'm Dan Persons. Please check out our Kickstarter by searching on the term Cinefantastique, and please visit us at cfqonline.com.
And in case you missed it, that was com. I think he spells it C-A-L-M, the way he says it. But let me say, Daniel, one of your best reviews. I thought that was one of the toughest movies to review because it's such a hot-button issue, and excellent job. I still have not seen the movie. I may eventually see it, but I figure it may be on the smaller screen that I see it. But you know what? That's a topic for another program, and I may actually dedicate an entire program to that. What I find so interesting is that my friends who are defending that film, more so than anything else, are all my gay friends. And it's like, really? Okay, what can I say? This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And, yes, I'm going to be on the air this coming Monday at 2 p.m. I will be sitting in for Janet Coleman, David Dozer, yes, the French couple, on Cat Radio Cafe. And lined up for that is gay activist writer Donna Minkowitz, who's just written a novel, which is actually an autobiography in science fiction form. And very interesting. We recorded the interview this afternoon. I am going to be going to PhilCon this weekend, and I'm going to be meeting there the director of the forthcoming Museum of Science Fiction in Washington, D.C., which has been making the news last week. It's been going on for 6 months, but for some reason, maybe it would help if I read the articles. But for some reason, I've seen all these headlines, and then all of a sudden, a PR person wrote me and connected me, and I spoke to the fellow this afternoon and figured, are we going to Skype something? Are we going to do something? I said, what are you doing over the weekend? He said, well, I'll be in Philadelphia at PhilCon. Bang. Okay. So I'm going to be recording an interview with him at PhilCon. And Ken Gale, he formerly of the comic book show Nuff Said, and also our local environmental activist and ornithologist. This guy knows boits. And I'm wearing a Cornell ornithology shirt today, by the way, having gone to Sapsucker Woods this month just to take a look at the birds. I mean, everybody should do that. It's wonderful. If you're stuck with the life of WBAI, go bird watching. It really brings the cholesterol level down. And so why was I bringing all of that? Oh, because Ken Gale is going to be interviewing a fellow whose father is one of the grandfather was one of the great collectors of ragtime music. And his book on his grandfather just came out, and we're going to listen to some of the old WBAI free music stores of ragtime festivals, which included the 92-year-old UB Blake playing some of his hits, which, well, UB Blake was just amazing. So that's Monday. But I've got a show now, and we have a wonderful guest who is this woman who I've really... let's see, which one is your mic? I think it's that one. who, for a while, I'm seeing all over the place, but didn't get like a proper introduction, right? And so I'm asking all my friends, what is that woman's name over there? An autograph party. And finally she gets wind of this and says, I respond to, hey, you. I knew that she was a doctor. And I mean, a bona fide medical doctor. I found it very interesting that some certain males, when they hear that D.T. Friedman, Danielle Friedman, is a doctor, take one look at you and say, are you like a psychologist? You know, they think the soft sciences. Say hi, Danielle.
Hi, Danielle.
Excellent.
Hi, how are you
Excellent.
Doing?
Excellent. Okay, and good night, Gracie's.
Yeah, that's
what
here.
Usually follows after that. Yeah. What kind of a doctor are you?
I am an internal medicine doctor. So for people who don't
the
know
The good
what,
time, for the good kind, yeah, for people to know.
I suppose. We do all the, we do Sorry. Basically all of the organs, you know, hearts, lungs, you know, kidneys, all the squishy bits.
Yeah.
You know.
All the good bits.
Yeah. Not the brain, you know, not the other parts. But,
yeah, the seven-pounder, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Kinds but, things, yeah. yeah, everything else we pretty much cover.
Yeah.
So if you go to the if you go to a doctor and you have a heart problem, you'll probably end up with an internal medicine person or, you know, a specialist would be a cardiologist, but internal medicine is the general.
Yeah, we discussed you a good deal when I had a guest on the show. Who's now I'm blanking on her name because, well, it's not her name, but her lead character is Alicia Barber.
Aha, uh-huh, yes.
What is the name of that writer?
E.C. Ambrose.
Thank you.
Yes.
Because I only remember the other name, that which must not be spoke on the air.
Exactly.
You know, and you played a major role.
To be
in
honest,
helping her with that book.
I actually, you know what? She had such good research and such amazing, you know, just almost, you know, it was almost technical skill on a writing level. I actually,
she's a good writer.
She's amazing.
Whatever name she uses,
she's an amazing writer, and she did the vast majority of it herself. Like I had, you know. I've always
felt like outing her pen name just because
no.
people should know how good she is under different names.
Let her do it herself.
I will. Actually, she slipped on the air.
Oh, did she now?
Yeah, I actually cut it out of the interview. I was very nice.
Yeah.
I'm a nice boy. Yeah.
Well, so she handed me her manuscript and was like, did I do it right? And most of the case, it was just like, yeah, wow. You know, she did a fantastic job. Yeah, this is the Barber's Battle series.
Yeah, well, when she came to read at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings,
she blew everybody away.
Oh, yeah.
It was excellent.
Just like last night. Mm-hmm. We had Rajan Khanna and Fran Wild, and the evening was put together in like 12 hours by Amy Goldschlager. And we had a huge audience of celebrities and, you know, science fiction royalty like Rick Bowes and Michael Swanwick and Marianne Porter. And, you know, really, 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 really cool people. And it was Guy Fawkes night. No fireworks. But except for those from the writers. And you were there.
I was.
You were part of Fran's entourage.
I was mainly Fran's entourage, but, you know, Raj is a good friend, too, so I was there to support him as well.
Yeah, well, you're now in the same writer's group, are you not?
I am.
The altered fluid writer's group.
Yes, I am the bottom of the birdcage, newest little baby member of altered fluid.
Yeah. We're going, assuming this show and radio station survives, people, longtime listeners to Hour of the Wolf know Altered Fluid because they've done about 8 times. They have come in and a writer takes a turn in the barrel by reading a first draft of a short story on the air and then having it critiqued live on the air by, well, friends, but people who can be rather hard, like blank, blank, how could you say that these people would do that? That's really wrong of you. And some of these people are harsh. And I'm trying not to use names, no. But they've all been on the show. And to me, this is like one of the most fascinating processes to put on the radio so that listeners get a look into what goes into writing. So what got you to writing?
To be honest, I don't really have a good answer for that.
Good answer.
I haven't. Yeah, thanks. I've kind of. I remember being little and carrying around a notebook and writing things down in it and pretending that that made me a writer. I was in a, semi-professional children's choir when I was little, and like the pictures all show me with like a binder of stuff.
Oh, that's great.
And even though like we weren't, doing it for, like I was carrying it around.
By the way, I want to see those pictures.
But, I can dig them up somewhere.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah.
Frizzy hair and a soft, three ring binder full of.
If anybody, by the way, is on Instagram, I'm going to take some pictures of Dr. Friedman during the show.
Oh, I should have.
Oh, yes, yes. You had to dress up for the radio.
Right, right.
Naomi Novik actually did that.
Did she?
My God, was she decked out. Charles Ardai, her husband, was with her, and it was the worst thing in the world because I had just learned how to drive, and we needed gas desperately, and I learned how to drive. I didn't know how to fill a gas tank, and there's Naomi in this, like, fabulous outfit standing on 2nd Avenue pumping gas.
That's excellent.
I wish I had taken a photo of that, but anyway.
Yeah. So,
what were you reading that inspired you into skiffy, into science fiction, fantasy?
Oh my goodness! I think that we can directly blame my science fiction fantasy tendencies on a man by the name of Johnny Sparkman, who was a friend of my father's in the Air Force, and he got my father into science fiction. And then, my father basically raised us on science fiction. I just kind of latched onto it.
I know a few Air Force people that were definitely into SF. Jack Chalker, who's a wonderful writer and was a very good friend of mine, was a former Air Force guy.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I went with him to an airfield to see some of his people, and they're all critiquing Jack's writing and other people's writing. They were all so well-read.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. There's something about the Air Force specifically.
I don't know.
Maybe they all wanted to be astronauts.
Possibility.
Do the Chuck Yeager thing or something like that.
Yeah.
So, we're concerned about getting the whole story in.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Maybe.
Yeah. Do you want a piece of music first, or you want to dive in, or is there anything else you'd like to tell us about yourself?
About myself? No.
Yes.
Well, if you've forgotten anything, I'm sure we can talk about it afterwards.
We're gonna try. 90 minutes. If anybody is in charge of this station, which is questionable, is listening, 90 minutes is too short.
Okay. Fair enough.
Too short. So am I, but so is never mind. So I'm also going to, while you're reading, think nothing of the fact that I'm going to leave the room. I'm going to do that to get you some water to drink during your reading.
It's appreciated, but are you sure that's wise, leaving me alone with your radio station?
I trust you.
That's a foolish thing.
I'm only going down the hall past WHCR.
Right, so don't break anything is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, basically.
All right, fair enough. All right, well, I can just kind of jump in.
Excellent.
All right. So I'm going to be reading a short story that first appeared in the Dark Faith Anthology, which is through Apex Books, edited by Maurice Broaddus and Jerry Gordon, the first volume. The title of the story is Paint Box Puzzle Box. An aspect of death came to a great artist, the most celebrated creator of beauty that had ever illuminated the face of humanity. It found him in his studio, blending a background on an immense canvas. "It is time," said Death, and the artist turned to face it. "That can't be. I ain't old yet." "It doesn't always work that way," said Death, "especially not with artists." It looked thoughtfully over the barely begun mural. "It is a shame, though. I would have liked to see what this was to have been." "It was going to be my masterpiece," said the artist, "a whole world full of love and hate and kindness and evil." He looked up at Death, piercing it with eyes that could capture the vitality of existence and spread it on canvas with a paintbrush. "Give me time to finish. When my work is done, I'll go with you without so much as a grumble." "How much time?" Death looked around the artist's studio at the stacks and stacks of unfinished paintings, each promising a taste of the pure delight that could be found in all his work. "1 year." The artist clutched his brush in his fist, willing Death with all his might to give in to his proposal. "Give me 1 year, and I will create the greatest masterpiece that has ever been gifted to this world." Death stood for a few moments, contemplating the canvas as if he could already see the wondrous creation that the artist promised. "I've always loved your work," it said. "1 year." The old folks had their easels set up in front of the pond on that first warm day when spring started to tip into summer. Willows and flowers were already starting to bloom on the canvases, and the jars of water were muddy with the sludgy drippings of dunked brushes. Unbidden, Carlisa's eyes jumped around, counting them. There was little Rose and Martha and James and Ella, and a flutter of panic surged through her before she saw the unoccupied easel. Leo wasn't missing. He was there, across the duck pond, holding his paintbrush to the sky to compare the colors. Carlisa let out a breath. Everyone had survived the winter. She ran down the hill to greet them. She had seen them for years on her way home from school and then work, a little cluster of geezers chattering in their sun hats in those precious days after the chill left the air and before the sun got too hot for them. Something about them called to Carlisa, and they were often the subject of her sketches. Leo had noticed her one day and waved her over to chat. The friendship they struck was easy and cheerful. The whole group had murmured appreciatively over her drawings, and Ella had kissed her on the cheek with her purse-string lips. The next time she visited, Leo handed her a paintbrush with a small canvas that she set on her lap like her sketchbook. She never really liked working with paint, or even really with color, but Leo's gentle suggestions brought a new life into all of her work, not just the amateurish pictures that the squiggles of her brush left behind. "Look deep," he'd say. "You gotta paint the whole depth of the object, not just the surface." He'd show her on his own painting, a woman in the distance walking a dog that looked for all the world like it was wagging its tail. "Don't just see the colors," he'd say. "Feel them." "Smell the colors," teased James from the other side of him. "Taste them, eat them for breakfast, and sleep with them at night." "Oh, you leave them alone, silly," said Martha. "Don't listen to him, dear. He's colorblind." This got a laugh from everyone. James' painting showed he was anything but. Leo held a dab of green on the end of his brush, stared at it hard. Carlisa focused her attention there, too. "Feel where that color comes from," he said, his voice low. "See it for what it really is." Carlisa could have sworn the color changed to blend in with the grass before he smudged it onto his canvas. "Did you see it?" he asked. Carlisa felt her head nodding, but she couldn't take her eyes off the delicate green of the grass in his painting. It was perfect in hue and value, but felt wrong, somehow, as if the color had been tipped askew. "Ain't this a world," Leo said. When Death entered the artist's studio a year later, a mural of incredible beauty and complexity awaited it. Images danced across the canvas, illustrating every imaginable aspect of human existence, from birth to death and before and beyond. The composition was breathtaking. Each tiny detail begged closer scrutiny, even as it drew the eye to the next and the next and the next. Death stood for hours studying the artist's creation. Eventually, it realized how much time had passed and pulled itself away. There would be eternity to appreciate the masterpiece, but Death had a job to do. It called to the artist to appear, praising his work with a choked-up voice that it barely recognized as its own. But there was no answer to its summons. The artist was nowhere to be found. Death found the artist's wife in the cramped apartment below his studio, stirring a kettle of stew on an open fire. The stones of the hearth were blackened with soot, and the room was filled with the clutter of daily life. "Where is your husband?" Death asked. "We had an appointment, and he's disappeared." "Oh, don't be ridiculous," said the artist's wife. "He's upstairs, working on his masterpiece." She ladled a spoonful of stew into a wooden bowl and dunked a chunk of bread into it. Death followed her up the rickety ladder to the studio and stood behind her as she looked around. "He must have stepped out for a bit," she said after a moment. She held out the bowl. "Would you like some stew?" Something about the woman's manner made Death very suspicious. He reached for the bowl but took her hand instead. The woman shuddered but did not flinch away. "He did not step out for a bit," said Death, "and this ruse does not fool me. You know exactly where your husband is." "You're mistaken," she said, and disappeared down the ladder. Death watched her go and didn't miss the quick glance she threw at the artist's mural. Carlisa watched Leo carefully, studying his technique and squinting to catch a glimpse of that moment when the color would shift out of phase at the tip of his brush. Leo's paintings flowed with life and energy, at the same time organic and carefully orchestrated. He'd direct her occasionally as she painted, sometimes fitting his leathery fingers over hers to demonstrate a brush stroke. The others gave her pointers, too, and her paintings developed as her eye matured to the new medium. She often stayed long after her friends had given up for the day, lost in the strokes and the dabs of paint on her cardboard palette. Sometimes she'd round the duck pond to stand in Leo's spot, trying for hours to see the world as he did. Death waited for days and days, but the artist did not return. The artist's wife and daughter took turns offering it food and drink, chasing away the children who occasionally climbed the ladder to gawk at it and giggle. Death passed the time as it waited for the artist to return by studying the mural. As the weeks turned into months, it realized that, as amazing as the mural was, there was not much to separate it from the artist's other work. This could not be the masterpiece that he had promised. Death tried to feel anger at having been cheated, but all it could really feel was loss. "You have to eat something," said the artist's wife. "At least drink some mead." Death declined and caught the longing glance toward the mural that she stole as she retreated. Death returned to studying the mural with new eyes. It was energetic and complex, as if it held a life of its own just beyond the painted surface. Death closed its eyes and reached out its hand. It was not entirely surprised when it met no resistance. Death's first step into the mural was tentative, though, as only one part of Death itself, the aspect that entered, was expendable. It was not fear that checked its progress, but awe. The mural was but a portal, a doorway into a world beyond, and in it there was love and hate and kindness and evil, everything that the artist had promised. And there was beauty and grace and ugliness and art and waste, but no artist. The days kept warming, and the humidity began to get the better of Rose. She only showed up in the early mornings now, the brims of her straw hats umbrella-like and floppy. "How do you see past that, dear?" asked Martha. "Oh, I love it when the weather gets hot enough to bring out the big hats," said Rose. "More surface area to play with." And her summer hats were certainly a sight to see, painted with scenes of forests and deserts, with fake flowers and ivy bunching from the crown. James lifted the front of the brim to grin into her face. "Oh, there you are," he said. Rose rolled her eyes and dabbed a yellow splotch of acrylic across his nose. "Hey, watch it, lady," James said, and laughed with everyone else as he wiped mustard streaks onto his handkerchief. Leo stole Rose's hat and replaced it with his own beige cap. The straw brim drooped nearly to his neck when he pulled it over his head, and the silk flowers bobbed in the breeze as he nodded to the rest of them. "I can see just fine," he said, and made a big show of walking straight into his easel. Carlisa nearly fell over laughing. The aspect of Death split itself into many parts, and together they scoured every corner of the world the mural revealed to them. The artist was not hiding from them there, not even by darting into the areas that Death had searched and dismissed. Death gathered all its parts into the original aspect and sat in a sculpture garden with a glass of lemonade. The artist was not in the world of his birth, and he had not disappeared into this new world, no matter what his wife seemed to think. It got up to walk around, passing welded amalgamations of steel scraps, stone drums, and a long bronze log with a half-hitch knotted into the middle. The world the artist had created even had its own artists, and their work was as creative or cheap or obscure or thought-provoking as art could be in their own world. It paused next to a sculpture of nested boxes and leaned over to see what was inside. Through the rainwater that had collected in the bottom of the center box, Death could see a tiny bronze fish that looked like it was swimming when the water rippled. Death stood straight, feeling as if it had been struck in the back of the head. It looked at the museum that the sculpture garden surrounded and had to restrain itself from running across the lawn. Just as it suspected, every painting in the gallery opened onto its own world. Death split itself into an uncountable number of parts and sent them to explore the worlds that lay beyond the portal in the artist's mural. A stranger wearing a blue business suit approached Carlisa as she held up her brush, trying hard to make the color turn like Leo had showed her that June morning. It was now the height of summer, and the heat of the day had chased her friends back indoors for a few hours. Carlisa's paintings and charcoals had improved drastically since that first spring. A small gallery in the city had slated her for a show later that year, and she was determined to bring the same life into her work as Leo seemed to breathe into his. "I'm looking for a friend of mine," said the stranger. "An artist, like you. I haven't seen him for years, but..." His eyes flicked over to the spot across the pond where Leo always stood, communing with his paintbrush. "I heard he spends some time here in the summer." The stranger's eyes were warm and his face was open, but something made Carlisa want to look into him, the way Leo had taught her to look into the depths of her subjects. Something froze and boiled inside the man who stood before her, and she withdrew her gaze as if she had been burned. "I'm sorry," she said. "The only other artists I've seen stay in the flower gardens at the other end of the park." The stranger regarded her for a long moment, and his eyes found Leo's spot across the pond again. "My mistake," he said. "I'm sorry to disturb you." He turned to leave and then stopped, his gaze lingering over Carlisa's painting. "It's beautiful," he said. "I haven't seen that kind of vitality in a painting since... in a long time." As the stranger strode off to wander around Leo's spot, Carlisa couldn't help but think of the time when Leo had twitched his paintbrush toward one of the daisies on Rose's hat. The paint on the end of the brush turned as yellow as the center of the flower, and Leo had dabbed it onto one of his own daisies on his canvas. The color was perfect, but felt sideways. The stranger ambled off, leaving Carlisa to stare across the pond. She didn't tell Leo about the stranger the next morning and watched for him all day. Leo went to his spot often, twitching his paintbrush at the sky. Carlisa wondered why the colors over there were so much more fascinating than the ones on their side of the pond. It was as if Death had feared. Each part of itself returned with the same report. In every world they found artists, and the work of art all contained worlds of their own, and worlds within worlds within worlds without discernible end. The artist was still nowhere to be found. Even though it was worried about the complexity of the maze the artist was hiding in, Death couldn't help but smile. It riffled through its memories of the search, wave after wave of appreciation and awe washing over it as it remembered the wonders it had encountered as it searched. More shades returned to the sculpture garden as the years wore on. Some of the more adventurous ones reported that they nearly lost themselves as they wandered deeper into the labyrinth. But there was no news until the last straggler made its way into the garden, pale as if it had split itself but glowing with excitement. "I have found a sign of his passage," said the part as it merged with the rest. "I have sent a shade of myself to investigate." The blue-suited stranger appeared many times that summer, thankfully after even the mornings became too hot for her friends to tolerate. "He's an elderly man," the stranger explained, "a great artist, dark of face, light of hair. He often wears a beige hat, and he has this habit of holding his paintbrush up in front of his eyes. You're sure you haven't seen him?" "Why don't you believe me?" asked Carlisa. The stranger thanked her for her time and left to round the duck pond. She stared at his retreating back and tried to see into the core of him. Suddenly, something in her gaze shifted, and she could see only a concentration of cold silence floating over the ground. She gasped, and her gaze shifted back. The stranger had reached the far side of the pond, headed towards Leo's spot once again. Carlisa looked away and knelt to focus on a puffball dandelion. When she concentrated hard, she managed to shift her gaze again. The fuzz stood out in her vision, and all she could see was the life aching to burst out from the seeds at its root. It felt dizzy, unbalanced. As if in a trance, she reached out her paintbrush and dabbed the gray-white onto its end. Her gaze shifted back once more, and she stared at the unsteady, ashy color at the tip of her brush for long minutes. When she managed to tear herself away from her woozy sense of triumph, the stranger had disappeared once again. What was it about that spot? Leo spent a lot of time there, sure, but so much that the stranger was drawn there like a dog following a scent? She left her canvas and paints where they were and rounded the pond. There was nothing special about Leo's spot. She stood where the grass had flattened under his sandals and tried to at least tease out a difference in the colors or in the patterns of the clouds in the sky. Nothing suggested even to her that her mentor stood there day after day, twitching his paintbrush at the trees. Until her view shifted. A riot of colors assaulted her eyes in streaks and dots and swirls. They swam around her in a whirling haze, forming and reforming into strange shapes and hues she had never seen before. It was as if she had fallen into the visions of a kaleidoscope psyche, immersed in a tank full of swarming tropical fish. Something was wrong with its alignment. She couldn't think in a straight line or hold the ground beneath her feet. No wonder the stranger knew Leo was here. This spot was a beacon of creativity, a celebratory proclamation of the existence of her mentor. Leo couldn't have known that it would attract such a frightening visitor. Her mind reeling, she carefully reached out her brush to touch a swirl of bright yellow and eggplant. The colors came away from the chaos around her, and she smeared them across the sky. The chilling stranger would not find Leo, she promised herself. She would hide every change he made to this spot until the stranger dismissed it as abandoned and moved on. And she would try to heal the wrongness she felt, try to correct the dizzy distortion until it felt right. If Leo noticed, he never said anything. The stranger didn't approach her again. The shade returned to the sculpture garden, discouraged. It was a dead end, it sighed. I thought I had tracked him to a world deep within the labyrinth, and indeed it seemed as if he meant to lead me there. But the signpost where the trail led fell into age as I watched. The artist has left it behind and moved on to hide somewhere else. The shade merged with the rest of itself, and Death sat dejectedly on the knotted bronze log to think. Carlisa practiced all summer, whenever the heat of the sun drove Leo indoors. She learned the patterns he had created, their rhythm and flow, and did her best to blend every change he made into something that seemed like it had always been there. She straightened skewed diagonals, trued the uneasy swirls, and as she learned more and more, she came to realize that this was not just an artist's creation of beauty for the sake of beauty. Bits of the beacon seemed to warp parts of time and space themselves. She learned to manipulate these aspects as well, weaving them through the creation that had become as much hers as Leo's. And then she began to set a trap. The days became cooler as summer faded late. Carlisa's elderly friends could stay longer and longer into the day. She invited them to display some of their own work in her upcoming gallery show, and they buzzed with excitement as they touched the colors of the turning leaves to their canvases. Leo had begun staring off into space a lot, often pausing from his painting for long minutes. The others noticed, and Carlisa heard them whispering to each other sometimes. Leo was getting older, they said. But Carlisa saw where his gaze fixed and felt a flush of shame whenever he looked over to his spot. How could she have presumed to correct her teacher's creation? But the blue-suited stranger had not found him, and she comforted herself with that thought. "I had a wife," Leo said once, suddenly. Everyone looked over at him. He had never spoken of any family. "A wife and children and grandchildren. Beautiful." He sighed, shook his head. "Ain't this a world, though?" No one said anything. James clasped his shoulder before turning back to his work, but only Carlisa noticed that Leo used a clean paintbrush to dab a tear into the sky of his own painting, favoring his garden with a soaking rain. She stopped erasing the changes he made to his beacon. It was his, after all. If the artist had bothered to create a false trail for it to follow, Death decided, there must be more than one. A spaghetti tangle, perhaps, the better to confuse and mislead. It journeyed through worlds at random, casting around for another trail. It left a shade of itself at the portals of each world to make sure it could find its way out again. It stumbled across many similar paths, but they all led to the same center locality. The Starburst Trail was the only sign of the artist's passage. It sent a part of itself down the trail again, unwilling to believe there was nothing special about that world at the center. Be sure, it told itself. An elderly man sat on a park bench in Carlisa's painting, his face mostly obscured by the fuzzy gray hair of the woman who was leaning down to kiss him. A pigeon stood next to him on the bench, leaning over to peck at the sandwich they were both ignoring. Behind them was the rest of the park, full of life but blurred into a barely perceptible background. The original charcoal sat next to Carlisa on the grass, one of her first and favorite sketches. It seemed flat and lifeless now compared to its canvas copy. At Leo's instruction, she sat for hours with the lovers, thinking about them as if they were real people. "'Cause they are real,' Leo said. "'They're as real as you and me, so you gotta find out who they are and how they live and listen to them when they tell you.' So she sat and asked them every question she could think of, shifting in and out of that strange world that offered her dabs of color if she would only reach out her brush. And suddenly she had felt them. The man was about to reach up and encircle his lover's waist with his arm, gently pulling her down into his lap so their hearts could beat against each other. The woman ached for intimacy, and Carlisa was no longer a painter, but a child wiping at a steamy window, each dab of paint rubbing a clear spot in the fog until the scene behind was revealed. But the window was tipped to the wrong angle. It was so hard to balance the strokes. The dusk was gathering purple shadows when she tore herself away. She vaguely remembered her friend's departure as the light faded, the faraway clatter of paints disappearing into baskets and evil easels loaded on to drag along frames. Only one easel still stood, canted on the uneven lawn, its canvas showing a man straining for an apple he just couldn't reach. She felt his desperate hunger as the tree teased him, raising and dropping its branches in the hot breeze. A movement caught the corner of her eye, and she shifted back to the real world. The blue-suited stranger had returned and was rounding the duck pond. Leo stood in his spot, his back to them both, oblivious to the approaching danger. "No!" Carlisa shouted, and ran along her side of the pond, knowing she would not be able to reach him in time. Leo turned at the sound of her voice, just in time to see the branches of a weeping willow wrap around the stranger and stuff him through a gash that Carlisa had cut into the fabric of their world. It would dump the stranger far away in time and space, somewhere not even Carlisa would be able to find again. Her trap had worked. Leo gave a wordless cry and ran to the place where the stranger had disappeared with a speed that belied his age. But the rift had healed itself after swallowing its prey, and Leo's gnarled hands met only the bare branches of the willow. Leo stopped pawing through the wooden curtain and dropped his head in defeat. Carlisa thought to call to him, but she could do nothing but stand frozen and watch her friend clutch the branches in his hands. When at length he looked over to her, his eyes were old and empty of hope. Carlisa backed away and ran, leaving her paint spread on the lawn around the kissing lovers. The message arrived at nightfall, passed in whispers from portal to portal between the artist's renditions of Death in each world. Follow the trail, but beware the girl. Follow the trail, but beware the girl. Follow the trail, but beware the girl. The shade that Death had sent to investigate the Starburst Trail never returned. It rained almost constantly the week leading up to Carlisa's show, so she only saw her friends when they stopped by the gallery to drop off their work. Carlisa fussed with matting and framing, but as much as she occupied herself, she couldn't help but notice that Leo never stopped by. Ella brought one of his paintings when she visited, and watched solemnly as Carlisa arranged it next to one of her early charcoals. Leo faced out of the monochrome sketch, holding a paintbrush aloft as if he were about to twitch a bit of color from the eyes of whoever stood before it. "It's just a bad time for him," Ella said. "He'll be back soon, don't you worry." But behind her comforting smile, Carlisa could see the set resignation of a woman who had watched her friends disappear over the years, one by one. Carlisa hugged her, swallowing back the lump in her throat. "He'll be fine," she said, and tried to believe it. The stranger was gone, wasn't he? Leo was safe. Death stood at a distance from the beacon, regarding it with curiosity and a little fear. This is where a part of itself had disappeared. "I am," the beacon announced with its color riot. "I exist." To Death, it said, "I am here." Death began to search. Opening night at the gallery was everything a young artist could have hoped for. People actually came, lured by the promise of beauty and cheap wine in clear plastic cups. Carlisa laughed as her friends posed pseudo-nonchalantly by their charcoal portraits, waiting to be recognized so they could launch into descriptions of their own paintings displayed alongside. She munched a handful of Triscuits. She watched visitors point at her work and lean in for a closer look. James passed by, Rose's enormous flowered hat bumping his shoulder as she held tight to his arm. "Success," James said with a wink, and the two of them threaded their way back into the small crowd. Carlisa smiled, but looked to the door for what must have been the 100th time that night. Why didn't Leo come? And then, as surely as she had felt the lovers longing to hold each other, she knew he was already there. Excitement thrilled through her, and she cast her gaze around the room to find him. She saw Martha jabbering animatedly to a woman with punk-dyed blue hair, and James and Rose chatting with another couple at the refreshment table. James was flirting shamelessly with the young woman, and she played along, lapping up the attention. Ella stood alone in front of Leo's painting, a hand on her cheek and smiling wistfully. She didn't find Leo until she shifted her gaze to the color world. There he stood in the corner, watching his friends enjoy themselves as if they were young again. If he noticed Carlisa watching him, he gave no sign. After a while, he nodded in contentment and slipped out of the gallery. No one looked up as he passed. Carlisa threaded her way to the door to chase after him, but he had disappeared into the night. She tried to pierce the darkness with her eyes, but not even her shifted vision revealed which way he had gone. She had just given up when she felt a shiver of emptiness pass behind her. The white-suited stranger didn't look up as he walked by, intent on the quarry that had left only minutes ago. Without a backward glance, Carlisa followed him into the night. The stranger's steps were long and quick with purpose. Carlisa ran nearly full out to catch up with him, her cork wedges thudding at the sidewalk like a panicked heartbeat. He didn't look up until she planted herself firmly in his path. "I know who you are," said Carlisa, surprised that her voice didn't shake when she addressed him. The stranger stopped, focused in on her with such intensity that she fought the urge to back away. "Ah," said the stranger, "the troublesome young lady. I've heard about you. Step aside, please." The stranger tried to walk around her, but she did not give way. "You can't have him." He stopped again, tilted his head. "I must have him," he said. "The universe is out of balance. Can you feel it?" Carlisa nodded despite herself, the tilt, the uneasy wrongness of the color world. "The artist feels it, too. He has been calling to me for a long time." "I won't let you take him," said Carlisa. "I've set more traps all around." "Will you walk with me, young lady? I have a long overdue appointment. I'd prefer not to be late." "You won't get anywhere near him." "That may be," the stranger allowed, and started again on his way. Carlisa tried to block his path again, but it was clear that the stranger was done playing on her terms. Eventually, she fell into step beside him, her mind whirling through arguments and plans. They walked through the streets in silence. Leo stood among the streaks and whirls of his beacon, oblivious to their approach. He twitched his paintbrush impatiently at the colors around him, and they flowed and combined and rarefied in his direction. Carlisa ran over to him, leaving the stranger behind on the path, and stood between them. The stranger approached, unhurried. "Don't worry," she told Leo. "He can't get you." Leo's hand clasped her shoulder. "I've painted them over," he said. "The traps were brave and clever. I don't remember teaching you how to make things like that." Carlisa turned to stare at him, a tickle of desperation rising in her stomach. "Why?" she managed. "When I reached the end of my life, a long time ago, child, I created a labyrinth where I could escape death. I planned to disappear into it just long enough so death would stumble around lost looking for me in there. Then I'd come back and spend as much time as I had left loving my family and creating a body of work that'd be worthy to be called my masterpiece. So what happened? Leo shrugged. I got trapped. Death got pulled in just like I planned, but I never accounted for how fast the maze would grow. Every turn I took trying to find the way back to my family, I just got myself deeper in, and the world just multiplied around me. By then, said the stranger, standing beside them, so much time had passed that your family had passed into my realm. Leo nodded sadly. I left signposts as far out as I could safely travel in every direction and still find my way back here before the labyrinth multiplied. I should have known how fast it would grow. I should have known. Damn fool. Carlisa grasped his arm protectively, lest the stranger tried to take him away while she stood there. The stranger held out his hand. Well, he asked. Leo looked to Carlisa, who held on to him as if she were drowning. You can let go, Carlisa. But Leo smiled sadly, shook his head. Looking into the core of him, Carlisa suddenly saw how very, very old he was. His gnarled hands, the comfortable wrinkles, the coffee-dark softness of his skin and eyes, they all seemed tired now that she really looked. Leo was weary, and he wanted his wanderings to end. Carlisa swallowed hard, trying to think of something to say that would make him stay. Plea after plea swam through her mind, but she couldn't make herself speak. Leo wasn't asking her permission. He only wanted her acceptance, and he would leave without either. Hating herself and determined not to cry, she slowly released Leo's arm. Leo kissed her forehead, and then her cheek, and then her hand, and then turned to join the stranger. Wait, Carlisa managed before they left her. Leo turned back. What about your masterpiece? I'd already made it, Leo said. I just didn't know it at the time. Can I see it? Leo smiled. Yes, child, I think you can. He motioned all around with an open hand, and Carlisa looked with the eyes that Leo had shown her how to use. And beyond the park she saw another world, and beyond that another, and another, and another. They bloomed before her, one from the other, each filled with love and hate and kindness and evil. As she watched, they shifted from their distortion and settled back into their proper alignment. They split off and nested into each other, universes and universes full of life. When she came back into herself, Leo and the stranger had disappeared. The tears she had been holding back were spent on her cheeks, and she clutched Leo's paintbrush in her hands. Her chest was heavy, and her throat felt choked closed, as if she would never speak again. She turned away from the beacon, now a monument, and slowly left the park. She touched Leo's paintbrush to her cheek and swept it deliberately across the sky. A warm rain fell over the city as she made her way back to the gallery. Death and the artist walked side by side through the park as old friends who had not seen each other for too long. I saw myself everywhere in your work, said Death. I would have thought you'd avoid me as much as possible. You can't have beauty without balance, said the artist. Just don't work that way, especially not with artists. These worlds that you've created, said Death, they are all so beautiful. It picked a sprig of gladiola, held it up to the light of a street lamp. This in itself is a masterpiece, it said. The artist laughed. What? This world, said the artist, a gleam of almost paternal pride in his eyes. Ain't even a one of mine. Whose is it? No idea. Ain't it a world, though? Ah, sure is. Together, they disappeared into the darkness.
Starry, starry night. Paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills. Sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now.
You've been listening to Paint Box, Puzzle Box by D.T. Friedman here over WBAI, New York.
Swirling clouds in violet haze reflect in Vincent's eyes of china blue, colors changing hue. Morning fields of amber grain, weathered faces lined in pain, are soothed beneath the artist's loving hand. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now, for they could not love you, but still your love was true. And when no hope was left in sight on that starry, starry night, you took your life as lovers often do. But I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful as you. Starry, starry night. Portraits hung in empty halls, frameless heads on nameless walls, with eyes that watch the world and can't forget, like the strangers that you've met. The ragged men in ragged clothes, a silver thorn, a bloody rose, lie crushed and broken on the virgin snow. Now I think I know what you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they're not listening still. Perhaps they never.
That was Vincent singing Don McLean, or perhaps the other way around, but you never know during Hour of the Wolf, which this is. Over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM, and over WBAI.org at better internets near you. And our guest this morning, my name is Jim Freund. Our guest this morning is by byline D.T. Friedman, by name Dr. Danielle Friedman, and by vocation, aside from being a doctor, really good writer. I like that. I've read some of your stories before, but that was nice.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
I really did. And for a radio show named after Ingmar Bergman, you know, it really sort of fit. He does a lot of death personifications, you know, not only in Seventh Seal, but in, not in Hour of the Wolf. Hour of the Wolf is a dark movie. Nobody's ever heard of it. It's one of his least known films.
Mm-hmm.
But it matches the mood. Not a fun film, though.
Oh.
Yeah, Bergman makes films for which they should not allow, razor blades. And that Hour of the Wolf is one of them. But anyway, nice reading, nice story.
Thank you.
So where did that come from?
That actually came from when I was volunteering at a hospital in Massachusetts. And I was working on a chemotherapy infusion ward.
Oh my God.
And
how much fun is that?
It was so fulfilling. It was amazing. The people in that it was an outpatient chemotherapy unit.
Mm-hmm.
So the interesting thing about that was
I spent too much time accompanying people.
Oh, so you know the kind of community that kind of grows in a situation like that. Yeah. Everybody, you know, everybody who has the same time of the same week sits in their armchairs, you know, gets their, you know, medication and like supports each other. And they're, you know, the people who come to support them. There was one, you know, little old woman who was the particular patient who inspired Leo. It was his wife. And she would go around and she would help every single person with something, no matter what it was, no matter if it was just tucking some hair behind their ear or bringing them a glass of water. And I was blown away by all of them and how beautiful they were together.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful story.
Well, thank you.
It really is. But there's a kind of person, which I am not and you are, that are able to look at things squarely in the eyes and see stark beauty out of mortal events.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something I can't do. I basically just put my thumb in my mouth and, you know, and blankie to my ear and start making noises.
Well, it's important to be able to do that. I'm actually, one thing that I didn't mention earlier is I'm about to do a fellowship in palliative care, which is, you know, pain control, end of life, bioethics, you know, and things like that.
Bioethics is a word I've never heard.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's a vast...
For one end-of-life situation I know, I wish more ethics
mm-hmm.
had been put to that particular bio unit.
It's actually interesting because...
I'll tell you when we're going out of here.
No problem. it's interesting because palliative care is actually a growing field right now.
Thank God.
Really, there is so much need in the hospital system.
In
so many ways, you know... Just somebody to take a step back and say, look, we're doing all these things to these patients. What are we doing for them? And how can we be humane as well as, how can we heal as well as cure? You know, and it's, I think, a very important branch of medicine that's getting, thankfully, more and more prominent in hospitals. And that's what I'm going to be training
so
to do.
It is so needed.
Desperately.
I cannot talk about this without anger. I'm serious.
I think a lot of people are in the same situation.
In me,
yeah.
You know, watching people basically fed morphine so that the people who are supposed to be doing the palliative care didn't have too much trouble. And with a Jewish patient being told, don't worry, Christ will accept you soon.
Hmm.
I mean, that's just wrong. There are other places, and I should mention a particular Catholic hospital, in which they were wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is not true at all places, and I'm not going to name names.
What I like is that there's kind of a growing awareness that the medical field at this point isn't really properly addressing those kinds of problems. And, you know, if you talk to anybody, everybody has a story about a time when the hospital system failed them and the doctors failed them in ways that, you know, a palliative care doctor, if they had been involved, might have been able to help with. I like to describe palliative care as, you know, hospital-based troubleshooting. You know, you...
Thank you. That's excellent.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant philosophy.
You go into a situation and it's, you know, it's a broken situation. This person is not being treated properly. They're angry. Their family's angry. The doctors are frustrated. The nurses are caught in the middle and everybody's just, you know, downward spiraling. And what, you know, sometimes it takes an outside perspective to say, here, I've seen this before. This person isn't talking to this person. This line of communication needs to be open before anything can go forward. And before these people can talk to each other, we need to address this patient's pain properly because it's not being addressed because everybody's focused on what is the proper drug for the cancer. And you know, the proper drug for the cancer is a vitally important part of medicine, but it's not the only part of medicine. And that's what palliative care is growing to fill, is that disparity between what is being done and what needs to be done.
Wow. Wow. That's all I can say is, you know, what a speech. That's I mean, no, it's great. It's great. I wish... I'm glad to see that there are people like you entering the field. You've not been a doctor for decades yet, who are thinking this way. It's good to know that the next generation, some members like you of the next generation of doctors, or the current generation, since you are now fully fledged, are, you know, recognize this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more recognition than people see from the outside. And I think it's also, it's a growing recognition.
Yeah.
And so I think what we're going to see is, you know, upcoming is that these kinds of, you know, palliative doctors, I think, are going to become more common. People are going to ask for them to be involved in cases more often and earlier, before the disasters have become disasters. Mm-hmm. And that's a vitally important part of it. You know, don't wait to call a palliative doctor until the person is coding. You know, call them early and have discussions about how to properly address medical problems as they arise.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I can't say anything. It's really just wonderful to hear that. It really is. And
I think that it will be, it'll do it. I'm really happy that I'm going into this field, because I'm going to be in a position that I'm going to do a lot of good. At least I have the capability of
it. Is this a long-term view? I mean, you're going to be a doctor for many years.
Yeah, I think that this is really my career. I actually started out as, you know, palliative care is really... The goal of palliative care is to minimize the trauma that's associated with chronic illness and, you know, and end-of-life issues. And I started out at the other end of things. When I started in the medical field, I was 11 years old, and I was working at a children's hospital with the Child Life Department. And Child Life, if you don't know about it, is amazing. It's a group of people that are, you know, they study to, they're specialists on the experience of children and how that relates to a hospitalization or an illness.
By the time I was 13, I'd spent about 2.5 months of my life in the hospital with various surgeries and stuff. It was a children's hospital.
Yeah.
I had a great bleeping time.
Well, you know how adaptable kids are to chronic, you know, to all kinds of things.
I was a terror down the hallways. not wheelchair, the go-karts,
sure,
basically.
Sure.
You know, because I had my legs out.
Did you like to take rides on your IV poles?
Yeah, but that was when I was older.
Another
point when I was in the hospital, and I wasn't a bicycle rider. Mm-hmm. I had a scooter, a proper scooter, so I knew how to, you know, make those IV poles. But I mean, I was the terror of Boston Children's Medical Center when I was about 11 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and if I get back today, same thing, same deal.
Well, so I started out volunteering in Child Life, and Child Life is dedicated almost completely to minimizing hospital trauma for children. And so now I'm, you know, minimizing hospital trauma for, you know, whoever needs me.
The other end of the cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is bound to bring fascinating philosophy to your writing.
I think so. I think it'll be interesting. I mean, the really good thing about it for me is it's the opportunity to practice medicine in the way that I got into medicine, to practice medicine. Because right now there's a lot of pressure on doctors. It's a very, you know, corporate attitude, you know, mill the patients out as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And this gives me the opportunity to actually, you know, get to know people and work with them in ways that they need to be worked with, you know, for proper medical care.
Yeah. I have terrible things to say about very good places. And
unfortunately, I do too.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll do that off air.
Definitely.
Although I must say, WBAI and Pacifica Radio would be a very good place to have a discussion about some of these things, because they're essential. They are to bring this to light, and this is not the kind of stuff you tend to hear about on commercial radio and mm-hmm. feel-good radio and all that. Not that we have to be feel-bad radio, but the point is to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm amazed by is you're talking about all this essential stuff and end-of-life stuff and stuff, kind of stuff I can't even begin to face without going, and you have a sunny disposition. Your writing is very life-giving, very caring and positive.
Well, a lot of people say that, you know, that actually the most common question that I get asked after I say that I'm going to be a palliative doctor, oh, isn't that so depressing? And there are depressing aspects of it. It's absolutely true. But the fact of the matter is that there's also this enormous opportunity.
Hi, Lester. We're all waving.
There's an enormous opportunity to do staggering, staggering amounts of good. And there's, you know, it's exceedingly satisfying when you get a chance to walk into a horrible situation and say, I'm here to help. What can I do? Who can I talk to? What can I fix? And that's why it's a positive thing.
Well, I said something before, I'm going to repeat it. Wow. I mean, that's really quite something.
Yeah.
Dare I ask about, I know you've primarily written short stories.
Yes.
But you intimated to me yesterday that you're actually working on longer fiction.
Yes, I'm actually writing a book, which is terrifying and the first time ever. So.
See, now you're talking about terrifying.
Well, yeah.
You can deal with end-of-life issues and stuff like that, just like that. But writing a novel, that's terrifying.
It, well,
you have a different philosophy than I have.
I don't know.
Can you talk? Most people cannot talk about novels that they're writing about. Is there anything that you can tell us about it?
Well, it's
comfortably.
Yeah, I can tell you. Actually, you're going to have to shut me up because I'm actually really enthusiastic about it. But I'm doing a YA novel, a young adult novel.
That's where the market is.
Yeah, it's science fiction. It's geared towards teenage girls. It's set in Indianapolis, near future Indianapolis. It's got brains in vats. It's got flying cars. It's got teenage girl angst and high school bullying, and you know. All kinds of fun
stuff.
All the
fun stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm having a lot of fun with it, actually.
Okay, good. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
By the way, let me tell listeners, if you would like to join the conversation and speak with either D.T. Friedman, Dr. Danielle Friedman, or all of the above, the telephone number here, WBAI, is 212-209-2900. Now, here is a caution. Not on topic, not on air.
Mm-hmm.
I do hang up on people who whoa, and the calls are coming in.
And I don't give medical advice over the radio.
Right, right. Good idea. And some other people at BAI. Anyway, put on your headphones.
Okay.
That's how you're going to hear.
Headphones on.
Magically hear the listeners. Headphones on, yes.
I'm trying not to spill water all over your desk.
Yeah, but don't mention that again.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, so nobody heard that. Nobody heard that. Right. Okay. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Hi. How are you doing?
Okay. How are you?
Hanging in there. One day I had found myself sitting at the breakfast nook table of a woman. Her husband was the dean of pharmacology at a major institution here in New Jersey. And he had cancer. And on his deathbed, he told his wife, don't take the drugs.
Mm.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a difficult issue.
It is. I fell out of my chair when you told me that story.
Yeah, it is a difficult issue. There are a lot of stories like that.
Okay. Well, that's my contribution.
Thank you.
Well, it's a good one. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good morning. And, you see, now our bleeping phone system here, we only have two working lines,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
So, and they like move up. So after the phone has rung X number of times, you get moved into a nether world.
Mm.
of non-phoningness. So if people want to call back, it's again 212-209-2900. But yeah, that's a provocative story.
Definitely.
Told very briefly, mm-hmm. that person wrote. Who are your favorite writers?
Oh, no, that's not even fair.
Okay. I did not.
Right now?
It always changes.
N.K. Jemisin.
Nora.
Yeah.
The wonderful, brilliant genius. That's an easy one.
She's terrifyingly brilliant.
Anybody who's ever read her, she's a favorite writer.
Yeah, well, how could she not be? She's amazing.
And she thought a lot of Lister.
I like China Mieville and Benjamin Rosenbaum and Ted Chiang. And
you finally mentioned somebody I haven't had on the show. Ted Chiang.
Really? On the show, please.
I would like to, but try to keep him tied down long enough. He's a very active guy.
He's unfathomably.
Anybody looking
as well.
Him up, by the way, it's Chiang, Ted Chiang.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. It took me an hour to figure out how to pronounce Ken Liu.
So anyway, just remarkable group of authors.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And talk about people who write incredible short stories. Ken Liu and Ted Chiang
mm-hmm.
are among them.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning. You are on the radio. Hello.
Here we go.
There we go.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Not too bad. I missed the title of the story that Dr. Friedman read and where it appeared, so could you please repeat?
Okay. The title of the story is Paint Box, Puzzle Box, and it first appeared in the Dark Faith Anthology through Apex Books, edited by Maurice Broaddus and Jerry Gordon.
Paint Box what?
Puzzle Box.
Paint Box, Puzzle Box. Yes, it did. When I had to over-announce it, Dr. Friedman had to actually hand me the sheet of paper, so I had it in front of me. It was not like an instant mnemonic.
And the name of the anthology where it appeared?
Dark Faith.
Faith, F-A-I-T-H?
That's correct.
From Apex Press.
And you said originally it's been reprinted?
I don't believe it's been reprinted, no.
Yet.
Okay.
How long ago was that published?
A couple of years. I can't remember. There are two volumes of Dark Faith by this point, as far as I know. So it was the first one. It was in the first one.
If it's not off topic, what would the theme of the Dark Faith anthologies be?
The theme was faith. Surprisingly enough, it was a horror anthology. And I was one of the few kind of more fantasy trending stories that was in it. The prompt was basically explore an aspect of faith. And I chose to explore creation myths.
And it sounded as if the novel that you were discussing, what was its title?
It doesn't actually have an official title. The working title is Meridian Gridlock.
Meridian Gridlock. Okay, that sounded a lot more science fictional.
It is a lot more science fictional.
You prefer one or the other aspect?
I like to think of myself as a science fiction writer. However, the only thing that I've published so far has been fantasy. I have a number of science fiction short stories that are circulating and fishing for rejection right now. I have a lot of... I love both in different ways,
mm-hmm.
but like I said, my upbringing was in science fiction, so that's where my heart is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
Bye now.
Take care. Okay, and good morning. You are on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
It's interesting that you played Vincent. That's a very appropriate song. The other two
I thought so.
The other two songs that would have been appropriate, had you thought about them, would have been Death and the Lady, which is a traditional English song John Renbourn recorded many years ago, and Death, Oh Death, Please Spare Me for Another Year.
Yes. What is that, Dowland?
What?
Is that John Dowland or somebody?
No.
Ancient Death, like that?
Which one? Death, Oh Death?
Yes, Death, Oh
Death.
Oh,
that's a traditional American song.
An American song?
Yes, if you ever saw the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes.
It, that sung in that particular movie.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Friedman,
yes,
I
sir.
Want to agree with you before I get to your story on one point.
Only have a couple of minutes.
I know. The Ambrose novel, tremendous. Not only did she research assiduously medieval medicine, but the general fabric of English social life.
Oh, she's incredible.
Amazing day to day. I want to ask you about your story. Did you do any research on the various personifications of death worldwide, either male, female, or gender neutral?
It's a very good question. Unfortunately, the answer is no. I didn't. I used actually.
Which isn't to say that you didn't nail it.
Well, thank you very much. I have this. I reuse kind of this version of the death archetype, a man in a blue suit, in a couple of different stories that I've written. I didn't do any particular research, although it seems really, really like a really good.
There are traditions.
Paper for
there are traditions. Like, most traditions in Europe and the English and the British Isles are male, but there are traditions, especially in the Hispanic Southwest, where death is always female, and some other places where it's gender neutral. I want to recommend a great story to you about death. It's by the Southern writer Richard Kennedy. It's called "Come Again in the Spring."
Okay. Hmm.
And it is a tremendous story about how death is foiled.
Uh huh.
Anyway,
those are the stories I like, foiling death.
Foiling death.
Not playing ping pong or walking off or...
The other great story, of course, about death is Appointment in Samara by John O'Hara.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Tremendous story.
It
anyway,
really is.
Good luck, and I hope you do
Thank
write
you
some
so
more
much.
Stories because your story really makes the mind's eye come alive.
Well,
she'll
be back on the show wherever she may be.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for calling.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
You too. Take care. Wow, nice calls.
Yeah,
nice calls.
I'm very flattered.
Very, very appropriate.
Yes.
And I had to hang up on that last caller like 2 weeks ago because it's like, you know, be on topic. And he said, no, I have to talk about Steel Eyes Fine. No. Sorry. Yeah, I almost did play a Steel Eyes Fine song. They have a new album called Wintersmith.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's not death, it's winter.
Okay.
It's the persona. Have you read that by Terry Pratchett?
I don't think I have.
Yeah, well, this is, I think you'd enjoy it.
I probably do. I usually love Terry Pratchett, although,
yeah, well,
it takes a lot of concentration for me to read him, because everything he says is like a triple entendre, and it's so brilliant.
Well, he's got four novels that are the Tiffany Aching novels. She's a young witch coming into her own.
Mm-hmm.
The first one being The We Free Men, and the last one being I Shall Wear Midnight, as in the black outfit a witch would wear. The third novel is called Wintersmith, and in which young Tiffany, she's probably about 14 or 15, just starting to come into blossoming, accidentally gets into a dark Morris dance and entrances Winter, who is now looking for her. And she has
cool.
to pretend to be, she has to learn to pretend to become the summer lady. I mean, oh, paganism and wonderful stuff. So Steel Eyes Span, whose outro we will be hearing in, about 2 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah, time flies.
I guess.
Wrote an album with Terry Pratchett based on that novel. Came out last week, just in time for All Hallows.
Wow.
I'm going to have to track it one morning. But
definitely.
I almost played a song from that because, well, it's Steel Eyes Span, who, if you don't know, you'll learn about, and Terry Pratchett, and what a combination.
Right.
New album. So, Burn Baby Burn Clapper Lister, huh? Yeah, he nods, because it's radio and everybody can hear him, you know, with this wonderful, beneficent smile and silently laughing. That's how radio works, right? Okay, we got a word out.
Absolutely.
Where do people find you online?
I don't actually have a website set up, but I do have a profile on Writertopia, and I also have a WordPress page that I don't pay too much attention to. And I believe the WordPress is dtfriedman at WordPress.
DTFriedman.wordpress.com.
I think that's it.
I happen to know that's it.
Oh, okay.
It was a leading question.
You did a lot more research than I did leading up to this. Yeah, so that's the main spot. And I have some of my stories that are up on that site.
Yeah.
And I think a bibliography. And if I don't have it, I'll put it on there. Soon, I promise.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, I can't thank you enough. I'm so pleased that we made this work.
Well, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. Yeah, well, you're it's an open invite, even if I have to go to another state to make it happen. except we won't be able to take phone calls, but we can still do radio.
Yeah. Be careful what you wish for. I might be back.
Ooh, excellent, excellent. So, thank you, Danielle. Dr. Friedman, D.T. Friedman is the name listeners should be looking for when they are looking for stories and perhaps a novel coming your way. Next week, scheduled to be on the program live as opposed to the last time was recorded, Kim Stanley Robinson. Want to talk about your fascinating people. If he is not going to be available, I've got another interesting agenda to talk about. But one way or the other, tune in next week, 1:30 till 3 a.m. And we're going to have to do a Doctor Who special before the 50th anniversary. You know that's got to happen. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, D.T. Friedman, for being here. And we'll be back next week at 1:30 a.m. Thursday morning or Wednesday night, depending on whether you're standing up or lying down. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way. We go out with, as I mentioned, Steel Eye Span and Sails of Silver.
murder is eternal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm messy attacked. I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talk about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game, well I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you, I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
it bitter. I see the poor, they can't take it no more. Going to legalize the herb, help the youths them to clear up their nerves. Not everyone wants to be a GA, and this is a reality. Time for us to change the pace and get right back in the human race. The only thing in life that we need is for the poor to survive, yeah. It's a pirate's game. I say that it's a crying shame, yeah. While the rich are getting richer, see the poor, they're turning into gangsters. And it's a pirate's game. It's a crying shame, yeah. The poor can't take no more, while the rich are getting stronger. Like some runner.
Wings with me, bum in, this morning, Jim Crying. Great show this morning, yeah. 99 Single is still alive right here. Burn, baby, burn. The show is called We Have No Choice Because We Burn. Them Furious, all glory, red, white, and blue to ashes. Celebrating Guy Fawkes Day, still right here. Burn, baby, burn style. Clappers. Yes, I am. 11 minutes after flag burning time, 11 minutes after 3 o'clock. 99 Sinker WBAI.